Our focus has been on kind of the metabolic as well as lipid metabolism, in particular in relation to cholesterol. So we were particularly focused on LDL, or low density lipoproteins, that are kind of our, what we call our bad cholesterol, and seeing if we can reduce those levels with our kefir.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series on metabolic health through the gut. In this series, we speak with experts about how gastrointestinal physiology, including gut microbes, can affect cardiometabolic health and body weight.
Hello, everybody. My name is Eamon Quigley, and it's a great pleasure to invite you to the latest episode in the Science, Microbes and Health podcast. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Ben Willing, who's a professor of gut microbiology at the University of Alberta and a former Canada research chair in microbiology and nutrigenomics in the Department of Agriculture, Food and Nutritional Science at the University of Alberta. He completed his PhD at the University of Saskatchewan, studying the role of microbiota in intestinal development in notobiotic pigs. His postdoctoral training was at the Swedish Agricultural University in Uppsala, Sweden, with Professor Janet Jansson, where he studied the relationship between the microbiome and inflammatory bowel diseases in a twin cohort. And at the University of British Columbia, with Professor Brett Finlay, where he studied the impact of antibiotics and fecal transplantation on infection resistance and asthma. His research group is currently working to understand both fundamental and applied questions in gut microbiology, with a particular focus on how it interacts with diet and antibiotic exposures. And indeed, that's going to be the focus of our conversation today, where his current interest relates to the role of fermented foods and their interaction with the microbiome. But first, Ben, welcome to this podcast, and I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I must admit, when I hear the term fermented foods, I really have difficulty in knowing exactly what we're dealing with.
Of course, you know, a fermented food that many of us would consume might be beer or wine. And, you know, while there are some potential health benefits associated with wine, we can't really report too many associated with beer consumption. And then we have also fermented meats, ranging from salamis as well as some fermented fish products, all the way to fermented dairy. Those are the ones that most people are familiar with, things like yogurt being probably the most common, as well as cheese. And the one that's in that space is kefir that I'm most interested in. Again, another fermented milk. And then now we're starting to talk about brine drinks and things associated with fermentation of vegetables, and as well as kimchi. So there's a long list that keeps going, but there is a diversity, whereas some of those foods, there's probably a clear association with health benefits, whereas others, people aren't consuming them with any thoughts of health benefits, such as, you know, salami.
So I think that's one of the challenges that, you know, the lay public may face, is that there are a whole variety of kefirs, for example, out there, and there are a whole variety of cheeses, etc. Is it possible to try and introduce some standardization into this area, or is that impossible?
Well, I think there's certainly a place that we can get to that's a bit closer to standardization than we're currently at. So for me, kefir is the clearest example because we've been studying it extensively. And, you know, I guess maybe to introduce what kefir is, it's a milk that is, at least dairy kefir is a milk that is fermented with a microbial consortia. So a bunch of different microbes that are found in a kefir grain. So it's almost like a biofilm, this microbial community that exists. And there is a diverse set of different bacteria and yeast in that community. So in the dozens of different types of microbes there. And those grains have existed for a couple thousand years. And those grains have just been distributed around the world, originating from the Caucasus Mountain area. But, you know, they've had 2,000 years to evolve. And there's definitely a diversity just within those grains. But if you look at those grains, there's still some clear commonalities to the microbes that you find. So there's some that you find that are always there and some that are a bit more sporadic. So if we compare those to what we find in most grocery stores, which is what we're calling kefir, those kefirs are being made in a different way. Rather than adding this grain, which has these microbes, to the milk and fermenting it overnight, they are taking microbial isolates and introducing them. So that would be, in theory, fine. because, you know, doing a commercial scale of these grain fermented kefirs is really logistically challenging. So, you know, isolating the organisms makes sense. But most of the kefirs that are available in the grocery stores, they're actually not using organisms that were isolated from kefir grains. They're using organisms that they've been using for things like yogurt production for years.
So can they really call themselves kefirs?
Well, at least that's what they're being called on the grocery shelves, right? And so I would suggest that they probably shouldn't. And there are some standards out there that suggest that here are the set of things that should be in kefir, but that's certainly not something that is upheld. You know, one of the clear things, if you look at the back of the bottle, you can look at the microbes that are there. And not to say any of the microbes there are bad, but those microbes very rarely contain any yeast species. And we know that kefir have usually multiple different yeast species associated with them. And many of those yeast species have been tested kind of directly or individually to see what kind of health benefits they can have. And they've certainly shown some. So the idea that we have kefir being sold that has no yeast in it would clearly suggest that it's not kefir.
So can I take you up on that point? So in the traditional kefir, which is this grain introduced into milk, which caused fermentation due to the bacteria, or I should say the microbial population it contained. Can you give us an idea of what range of microbes were involved in the traditional kefir?
There's quite a diversity, but there's some Acetobacter, there's some Lactococcus, and then there's some organisms like Lactobacillus kefirinofaciens and Lentilactobacillus kefiri. And so you can imagine those names very clearly come from where those organisms were isolated. And the organisms like kefiri and kefirinofaciens are really important for production of that matrix, the exopolysaccharide that's generated through the fermentation. Those are the organisms that do that specific to the kefir grain.
You also mentioned yeast.
Right. So some examples of yeast are things like Cluveromyces marxianus. We often also have some Saccharomyces, and we have some Piscia, so Piscia fermentans, as well as Kazakhstania unispora, as well as some others. So there's a diversity there. Most of them are not so far distantly related from Saccharomyces, but they are relatively specific.
Of course, many people would be familiar with Saccharomyces and Saccharomyces boulardii in particular, and its role in health outcomes. So I guess the critical point you're making is that in traditional kefir, you had a consortium of microbes, which include the bacteria that you mentioned, then plus a range of yeasts, and that in store kefirs that are sold, they don't necessarily contain that similar consortium. Is that correct?
That's exactly it, yeah.
So we've got a major problem there.
Well, I certainly think so. And, you know, I think the collective of the scientific community, as well as those who regulate the food industry, I think there's a space to contribute to improving this.
Okay. So now moving on to your own research. Looking at some of your recent work, I noticed that quite a bit of your work is done with traditional kefir, which of course gets back to how we started this conversation. And tell us a little bit about what properties you have found in the laboratory using traditional kefir or commercial kefir that may be that have the potential to impact on human health.
Right. So kefir as a, you know, the grain fermented kefir has been associated with many different health outcomes. And you can find reports on metabolic health, as well as things like cancer, and has kind of a diverse set of applications. But our focus has been on kind of the metabolic as well as lipid metabolism, in particular in relation to cholesterol. So we were particularly focused on LDL, or low density lipoproteins, that are kind of what we call our bad cholesterol, and seeing if we can reduce those levels with our kefir. And so that's one of the things that we've made some comparisons between different grains. So we had that initial question of, well, do different grains have equal outcomes as far as cholesterol lowering effects? And then also, how do they then compare to the commercial kefir that are available?
And what did you find?
So the main finding is that, you know, not all grains are exactly the same. So some seem to be a bit better than others. Although the grains that we looked at, they were pretty consistent in their ability to lower cholesterol levels. And I should say this is starting in a mouse model, a high cholesterol challenged mouse model. And so we found some grains were particularly good at lowering those cholesterol levels. And the commercial kefir looked like our control group, which was just getting unfermented milk as part of its diet.
So have you been able then to zoom in on the components of this consortium, which may have the greatest effect in terms of this lipid profile?
Right. So, you know, it's certainly still a work in progress, but we have made some advances in understanding that. So one of the things that we did to follow up from that initial work is to then actually isolate a set of organisms from our best grain. And then we combined those together. So we took what we thought were the best examples of things that we might be helping. So we had 9 organisms, 5 bacteria and 4 yeast that were then used to make kefir in the lab. And so when we did that, we tried it with that full consortia of 9 organisms. And that was the first study we did. And we found that that was just as good as the grain fermented kefir. So that boded really well. And then what we did is we tried removing different groups of organisms. So we removed the yeast organism. So we removed the 4 yeast. And when we did that, we got none of the benefit. So, you know, that might point, well, the yeast are important. But we also tried removing the kefiri and kefir innovations from the fermentation. And when we did that, we also saw a loss of the cholesterol lowering benefits. So we believe at this point that both of those types of organisms, so the yeast as well as the kefiri and kefir innovations, are important. But we think it's probably because those 2 sets of organisms are interacting in some way. And, you know, there's some more kind of digging down into, is it one of the yeast that's particularly important, or is it the kefiri or the kefir innovations that is more important? But certainly that we're identifying that, you know, there's something going on interacting between those 2 sets of organisms. We think it's likely related to a peptide that's generated between those 2, but we have yet to confirm that.
So you really are working towards developing the ideal kefir for this particular indication.
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah, we're trying to make something that is going to be and can be used at a commercial scale because it's no longer associated with the grain.
Now, you've also worked on immune responses. Are these mediated by different organisms, different types of kefirs, or is there some overlap between the metabolic effects and the immunological effects?
Yeah, so in our studies that we've, you know, looked at the immune modulation outcomes, we actually really haven't seen that clear kind of anti-inflammatory type response with our kefir. And I guess I should say that we've kind of followed up with a human cohort doing essentially the same thing with our kefir versus our pitched kefir with our 9 organisms as compared to our commercial kefir, saw the same things. But although we didn't see any clear inflammatory markers, we did see some things that are associated with cardiovascular health, and so some endothelial markers. So VCAM and ICAM, they're 2 molecules associated with, they're clear markers of kind of potential risk of for cardiovascular health.
Very interesting. Now, you mentioned there some human studies. I know that quite a bit of your work has been in animal models. How much have you been able to translate into human studies?
Right. So in our first, we did a bit of a pilot clinical trial. We took a group of men with mildly elevated cholesterol just because of, you know, logistical reasons and limitations on funding. We started with that population. And so when we did that, we did it in a crossover design. So either get the commercial kefir first, or you get the traditionally produced kefir, or what we call a traditionally produced kefir, first, and then had a 4-week washout, and then gave the other intervention. And so, you know, the key outcomes is that we did get some lowering of our LDL cholesterol. We did get some lowering of our VCAM and ICAM, those markers for cardiovascular risk. And when that's with our traditional fermented kefir, and when we looked at the commercial kefir, we really saw no changes at all relative to their, you know, that same individual prior to intervention. The only one marker that we saw that went up was actually an inflammatory marker, which was, you know, probably not too concerning given that the level that we saw change, but it certainly didn't have any benefits.
So what you're saying, and I'm just trying to summarize it, what you said is really incredibly important. So from both your laboratory work and your human work, it seems to me to be absolutely clear that we should be very strict in applying the term kefir in biological terms, because kefir, which is not traditional, seems to have no benefits or no impact.
Well, certainly for the things that we were measuring. And I should say that, you know, there's clearly some large studies with yogurt that have shown some positive outcomes. So, you know, I always am careful about to overstate this, say something doesn't have any value. But I think there certainly, if we're looking for the benefits that are tied to kefir, that it truly should be a kefir. And one of the things that we've recently been, I'm working with a group of other researchers in Canada that are kind of trying to understand the landscape of fermented foods in Canada. And one of the things that we recently did was a bit of a survey of Canadians. So I think we had 4,000 Canadians and said, well, what do you, why do you consume this fermented food and what fermented foods do you consume? And so for many of those fermented foods, they say they consume cheese, and most of the reason for eating that cheese was because it tasted good. But for things like kefir, actually, the more people consumed it for the reason of health benefit than those that consumed it for either didn't know or was associated with just because it tasted good. So I think, you know, consumers are actually expecting a health benefit and the things that are maybe reported as health benefits with these products. So the idea is that I think that they should be getting what they are buying, or, you know, they think they're buying at the end of the day.
Because when it comes to probiotics and prebiotics, the expectation is that there will be a health benefit if you go by the definitions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, I will also say that, you know, the industry is not doing anything wrong in the sense that they are producing a product that is food. It's still healthful and they're not making any claims. On there, you know, there's no packaging claims, there's no claims that they're making. And so, you know, I don't think they're breaking any rules in that regard. But I think if we want to provide something and kind of maybe compel the industry to maybe start using some of these organisms that they're maybe a little bit less familiar with, is that there's going to be value to the consumer.
But what are you working on right now, or what are your, where do you think your research is headed to over the next few years?
So we're just starting a larger clinical trial, and we're actually getting into a population with prediabetes and type 2 diabetes, particularly because one of the things that we found in our that pilot study was that the participants that seemed to have a bit of an elevated glucose actually got a fasting glucose that dropped. So we're doing a larger trial, in both including male and female participants, so really trying to improve the overall quality of that. Those studies will still be looking at lipid markers within that group. So that's, you know, a big thing that's just starting in and looking at hundreds of participants, or well, more than 100 participants. So hopefully to have some robust results in that space. So that's one key element of what we're looking at. And then also trying to get at what are the specific mechanisms. So can we tease apart what is the molecule or whatever that is causing this health outcome? And then other space is really trying to, it's a little bit separate, is getting at the fundamental mechanisms through which microbes drive metabolic disease. So identifying specific bacteria that are, and I use notobiotic models for this, is adding microbes in and seeing how they add to a adverse metabolic outcome. And then trying to also understand how that relates to the microbial behavior, because it's not always about what microbes are there, but then how they're behaving. So are they in a more pro-inflammatory state where they're kind of being a bit more virulent, even though they're not strict pathogens, but they're kind of pushing them to be a bit more aggressive on the intestinal epithelium and the like.
Now, we focused a lot on the microbes, but how about the medium in which they're this given? So does it depend what type of food that is incorporated with the bacteria or the yeast? Or does that make a big difference?
That's another great question. And that is a space that we are starting to consider. So certainly there is pressure on dairy as far as sustainability in that those regards. So we are actually looking at, can we get the same health benefits when we use this consortia to ferment a non-dairy alternatives? So things like oat milk and the like, and to see, we've gotten to the point where we have fermentation. We can get that to create a fermentation. We get a reasonable microbial cell count that would be equivalent to what we get with dairy. But we have yet to test that now in our getting back to our animal models, starting from there again. Can we get the same benefit when we're fermenting that different substrate?
Exactly. And I think substrate is an important word there, because of, you know, you mentioned earlier the possibility that it's some peptide or some other molecule that's being produced, maybe in collaboration between yeast and bacteria. But of course, that could be dependent on what the substrate that they're provided as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. And maybe if we can figure out what that, say, peptide is, maybe we can find a protein alternative that would still facilitate that interaction to make the, but it, you know, at the same time, you know, we're not trying to create a drug here. We're just trying to create a food that is healthful, because that's, you know, that's the intent of our research. Pharmaceutically, that maybe that would be a you know, somebody could take that a different direction, but our focus is trying to make foods that are healthy for people.
Do you foresee changes in regulation in this area?
I think so, but I think that'll probably be a while before we see that a significant change in that regulation. And I think that maybe there is just maybe not a clear appreciation, and that's, you know, having this discussion today is hopefully helping bring a bit of that to the fore, so that people start to think about it. Should it be regulated a bit differently?
And of course, ISAP have recently produced some guidance on the whole area of fermented foods, which I think will also be helpful to people. Because I think what you said today is absolutely fascinating, but it's also incredibly important that, you know, this is an area where there are a lot of products out there which may have highly variable contents and which may or may not have much to do with traditional kefir. They may or may not be able to assume that they have the same properties biologically as traditional kefir. I think that's a very important message.
Yeah, we think so. And I think, you know, as we continue down this path is, you know, thinking about all the fermented foods that we are then making those health associations with, including things like kombucha. I think a lot of people are now, you know, it's a bit of a fad that kombucha is how many different brands you can find in the stores now. And we've already done a bit of, you know, piloting to see how different are those kombuchas that we find in the store. And some of them look, you know, pretty reasonable, that my right microbes are there. And other ones, they're maybe loaded with bacillus and look like carbonated bacillus water. So it's maybe another space for people to think about.
Absolutely. Obviously, a very challenging area. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you today. And I hope our audience, I know our audience are going to benefit greatly from your insights and from the great work that you've been doing. Thank you very much, Ben.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org, and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.